Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode will be a bonus recap of the Karen Reed trial. And in this episode, we will be covering multiple days because I am a bit behind on my recaps. I've been pretty busy working at our ice cream shop, Chris and Kate's, but I have been loving it so much when listeners pull up in the drive-thru and show me that they're listening to Mama Mystery or even just acknowledge that they know who I am. It's like the coolest thing ever. Always makes my day. It totally blows me away. But with that, it just really limits my time that I'm able to write these episodes since I'm really a one-woman show over here. And yeah, I could probably hire help, but I just can't afford it. So I appreciate everyone always being so supportive and understanding, regardless of my consistency on these bonus recaps. And without further ado, let's go ahead and dive into the end of the last week and then last week. So I guess what I'm trying to say is May 5th and 6th and then all of last week. We're going to cover it all in this episode. I'm going to break it down day by day, and I will have timestamps for each of the days in case you really only care about a certain day. So you can check that out in the episode summary. Without further ado, let's get into it. In the second week of Karen Reed's murder trial, or retrial, I should say, much of the drama centered on testimony from Jennifer McCabe, who is a close friend who was with Karen Reed on the morning that they discovered the body of Karen Reed's boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe. Now, Jen McCabe is considered a key witness for the prosecution. She was at the same after party as John O'Keefe on the night of his death, and she joined Karen Reed in the frantic early morning search that led to the grim discovery of his body in the snow. Now, the defense, however, portrays Jen McCabe as something else entirely, the alleged quarterback of a cover-up, effectively accusing her of coordinating a false narrative to pin John O'Keefe's death on Karen Reed. In fact, when asked about Jen McCabe outside of court on Friday the 6th, Karen Reed herself said, "I would maybe use the word quarterback," suggesting that Jen McCabe was orchestrating events behind the scenes. Over 3 days on the stand, Jen McCabe endured hours of grilling by defense attorney Alan Jackson, who aimed to expose inconsistencies in her story and suggest that she had a role in the cover-up. So let's recap Thursday and Friday's trial proceedings, focusing on her testimony. By Thursday, Jennifer McCabe was on her second day of testimony, this time under cross-examination by Karen Reed's defense team. Alan Jackson dove straight into McCabe's relationships and communications, trying to show the jury that Jen McCabe might have coordinated her story with other people. He asked if Jen McCabe and her friend Carrie Roberts, who was also present during the search, had discussed their testimony in advance. Jen McCabe flatly denied any collusion, saying they only talked about the experience of testifying, not about what they would say. She said, quote, "We both know what happened. We don't have a story. There is no story. We were there. That's it." Portraying herself as Carrie Roberts and her as just normal moms who had never been through anything like this before. In other words, she claimed that there was nothing to line up because they were simply telling the truth of what they saw. But Alan Jackson was not satisfied with that answer, and he pressed Jen McCabe on her contacts with others after John O'Keefe's death, pointing out potential omissions in her prior statements. Jen McCabe had previously told an outside law enforcement agency that after arriving home on the morning of January 29, 2022, after they found John's body, she had only made two phone calls, one to her husband, Matt McCabe, and one to Carrie Roberts. Under cross-exam, however, Jen McCabe had to actually admit that she made additional phone calls that she, quote-unquote, forgot to mention. She acknowledged calling John O'Keefe's mother, as well as her own brother-in-law, Brian Albert, who was the owner of the home, and even contacting her victim witness advocate from the DA's office. Alan Jackson highlighted that these omissions suggest Jen McCabe hadn't been fully forthcoming. Jen maintained that she wasn't trying to lie. She just simply didn't remember those calls offhand. But this exchange showed the defense digging into any cracks in her memory or her honesty. Next, Alan Jackson zeroed in on the timeline around the moment that John O'Keefe likely sustained his injuries. He asked Jen McCabe whether she heard anything unusual the night that she was at her sister's house. Did she hear a collision or a thump or someone outside shouting for help or tires screeching? To all of those answers, she answered no. She testified that she did not hear any crash or cries in the early morning hours. She also said that when she left the house about an hour after Karen and John drove off, she did not see John O'Keefe lying in the yard. Now, this is a critical point because the defense suggests that John O'Keefe was attacked later, perhaps after Karen Reed had left, whereas prosecutors allege that he was hit by Reed's car around 12:30 a.m. and left there all night. Jen McCabe's statement that she noticed nothing amiss when leaving could support the defense's theory that John O'Keefe wasn't there yet, or could simply mean that it was dark and snowy and she missed seeing him. But one of the most dramatic exchanges on Thursday involved what Karen Reed supposedly said when John O'Keefe's body was found. Under direct examination earlier, Jen McCabe had testified during the chaos of that morning that Karen was frantic and at one point questioned herself, asking, "Did I hit him? Could I have hit him?" in disbelief. But Jen McCabe also claims that as soon as they found John O'Keefe in the snow, Reed effectively admitted guilt. According to Jen McCabe, Karen started screaming, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," over and over as she became hysterical. Now, this is hugely significant because, of course, it sounds like a confession, and it's really the only thing the prosecution seems to be really holding on to. Jackson challenged Jen McCabe on this point because it turns out McCabe hadn't consistently reported that quote in every prior proceeding. In fact, during earlier proceedings like the grand jury, McCabe apparently never mentioned hearing Karen Reed yell, "I hit him," or at least there's ambiguity about it. So Alan Jackson asked whether Jen McCabe had told the grand jury about Karen's alleged quote.
And Jen McCabe responded that she was unsure if she told the grand jury, but she didn't waver on what she claims happened. In a firm tone, she testified, quote, "I have testified a number of times, but I was there the morning of January 29th when your client said, 'I hit him, I hit him, I hit him,'" end quote. So regardless of what she previously reported, she insists that she absolutely heard Karen say those words at the scene. Now, this was a pivotal moment in her cross-exam because the defense has implied that Jen McCabe conveniently remembered the "I hit him" quote later on to incriminate Karen Reed, since none of Jen McCabe's initial interviews and reportedly up to 12 earlier occasions where she recounted that morning, she never included Karen outright confessing. Only later did Jen McCabe and other witnesses and a first responder come forward saying that they heard those words. So Jackson hammered that discrepancy, and if Karen really blurted out, "I hit him" repeatedly, why didn't Jen McCabe report that immediately to police or during the grand jury? Like, that would have been the time to say it if you were so sure that you heard it. This back and forth had the courtroom really tense. Was it a memory lapse or a sign that her story was evolving over time? The judge even had to step in at one point, instructing the jury to disregard a comment when Jackson argued that the situation was a textbook example of witnesses colluding. Clearly, the defense was planting seeds that Jen McCabe might be lying or mistaken about what Karen said in the heat of the moment. Alan Jackson's cross on Thursday wrapped up with both sides holding their ground. Jen McCabe portrayed herself as a genuine friend who was just horrified by the tragedy, adamant that she told authorities everything she knows. The defense painted her as a potentially unreliable storyteller with a selective memory. By Friday, her cross-examination continued and eventually concluded, spanning several more hours of meticulous and at times very heated questioning. If Thursday's theme was questioning McCabe's honesty and possible collusion, then Friday's focus was squarely on timeline inconsistencies and digital data that could make or break her credibility. So let's break down the key moments from Friday's testimony. One of the first points that Alan Jackson revisited was what time Jen McCabe last saw Karen Reed's Lexus SUV outside the house on that fateful night. Earlier in the investigation and in the first trial, Jen McCabe had been pretty specific. She said that she glimpsed Karen Reed's vehicle at around 12:45 a.m., and she even tied that recollection to a timestamp on a text message that she received at 12:45. This detail was important because if the SUV was still there at 12:45, then it suggests that John O'Keefe and Karen Reed hadn't left the party yet by that time. But here's the thing, evidence from the first trial undercut that timing. A Massachusetts state trooper had testified that Karen Reed's cell phone auto-connected to the Wi-Fi at John's house around 12:36 a.m., implying that Karen and John left the party and were at John's house by 12:36. That would make it impossible for Jen McCabe to truly see the car at 12:45. On Friday, when she was confronted with this, Jen McCabe backed off her original certainty and now admitted that she couldn't be sure of the exact time that she saw the SUV. Essentially, she retracted that 12:45 timestamp, saying that she might have been mistaken about the timing. The defense seized on this as a significant shift in her story, which was a sign that Jen McCabe's memory had changed, perhaps to fit the evidence. It didn't escape the jury that Jen McCabe's initial timeline helped the prosecution, but once contradictory tech data emerged, she adjusted her recollection. And this was exactly the kind of inconsistency the defense wanted to highlight. The cross-examination then turned to a series of phone calls that happened in the window after Karen Reed and John supposedly left the party, roughly 12:30 to 1 a.m., Phone records show that between 12:29 a.m. and 12:50 a.m., Jen McCabe's phone placed multiple calls to John O'Keefe's number. In fact, Jen McCabe repeatedly called John's phone during that span, calls that he never answered since he was by then unresponsive in the yard. Now, here's the weird part. Jen McCabe testified that she has no memory of making those calls. She suggested that they were accidental butt dials and not deliberate calls. Now, I want you to think about the last time you actually made a butt dial and the last time that you made like 7 in one night, because when we go through this trial, you're going to hear about so many butt dials that it really just seems too good to be true, too coincidental. But Anyway, Jen McCabe suggested that they were accidental butt dials and not deliberate calls to John. But even more curious, she said that those outgoing calls didn't appear in her iPhone's call log. And now it's not entirely clear why that would be. One theory is that if she dialed from her Apple Watch or if the calls were very short, then they might not log. But that is speculative and I don't really believe that. Jen McCabe firmly denied that she was intentionally trying to reach John O'Keefe during that window. She insists that she wasn't aware of calling him. The defense implied the opposite, which was, why would McCabe's phone essentially be pinging John's phone over and over unless she was urgently trying to contact him? Were these truly random pocket dials, or was she trying to wake John or find out where he was or where his phone was? It's an unanswered question, but by raising it, Alan Jackson got the jury thinking that Jen McCabe's activity that night was odd and maybe not fully explained. Now let's talk about the Google search at 2:27 a.m. This, of course, is the elephant in the room, the piece of evidence that has spawned countless debates. A Google search for how long to die in cold, performed on Jen McCabe's phone in the early morning hours of January 29th, 2022. The timing of this search is absolutely critical. The defense alleges that Jen McCabe made this search at 2:27 a.m. a few hours before John O'Keefe's body was found, which would imply that she knew something was seriously wrong before anyone officially knew. In opening statements, Karen Reed's attorney, David Yannetti, told the jury, "You will ask yourself, why would someone Google how long it would take for somebody to die in cold unless that person knew someone who was either in that situation or would be in that situation?" The prosecution, however, maintains that Jen McCabe only did that Google search around 6:23 a.m. after John was found and at Karen Reed's request, because Karen was apparently worried about how long John had been out in the cold. So which is it? 2:27 a.m. or 6:23 a.m. On Friday, Alan Jackson confronted Jen McCabe with this head on. Jen McCabe flatly denied ever Googling anything about dying in the cold at 2:27 a.m. She testified, as she did in the first trial, that the only time she searched that question was around 6:17 to 6:23 a.m., and only because a panicked Karen begged her to do it. According to Jen McCabe, after they found John in the snow, Karen was frantic and kept asking her to search for how long someone could survive in those conditions. So Jen McCabe grabbed her phone and did so. The notorious misspelling, Hoss Long, in the query was likely a result of her shaking hands typing quickly. Jen McCabe also swore that she never deleted any such search from her phone. To her, the defense's insinuation that she Googled this in the dead of night hours before the discovery is simply wrong. Now, to be fair, a digital forensics expert had testified earlier in the trial to explain the dueling timestamps. We already talked about this expert, Ian Whiffen from Cellebrite, essentially telling the jury that the 2:27 a.m. timestamp was likely a quirky artifact of how iPhones and Safari browser tabs work. Jen McCabe had looked up a local sports website, Hockamock Sports Scoreboard, around 2:27 a.m., then left that browser tab open. Later, around 6:23 a.m., when she went to Google how long to die in cold, she reused that same browser tab. So the phone logged the opening of the tab as 2:27 a.m., even though the search itself happened after 6 a.m. In other words, the defense's much-touted 2:27 search might just be a misleading timestamp and not actually early morning, like an early morning smoking gun. But Jen McCabe's testimony aligns with this explanation, and she insists that the search was after 6 a.m. when they were desperately trying to make sense of his condition. Still, Alan Jackson didn't let Jen McCabe off that easily. He pointed out a new contradiction, that Jen McCabe testified that another friend, Carrie Roberts, actually witnessed her doing the Google search around 6 a.m., presumably to bolster Jen McCabe's story that it happened then and not earlier. However, according to the defense, Carrie Robert has denied seeing Jen McCabe search that on her phone. Essentially, one of them is wrong, either Carrie's memory or Jen's. And that's a problem for the prosecution. Even if the witnesses can't agree on when the search happened, it still casts doubt, which is all the defense has to do. Alan Jackson hammered that someone's lying or misremembering angle to suggest a cover-up. If McCabe did search at 2:27, perhaps she later asked Carrie to say that it happened at 6, and then Carrie refused to go along. Jen McCabe, for her part, stuck to her guns and maintained that Karen demanded she make the search and that she did so in front of Carrie. This Google search saga remains one of the most puzzling timeline issues in the trial. Jurors are left to decide if it was an innocent quirk of technology or evidence of guilty knowledge by Jen McCabe and then, by extension, a wider cover-up. Another detail that got a lot of attention was Karen Reed's Lexus SUV's broken taillight, specifically when and how Jen McCabe first heard about it and how she described it. We all know that on the morning of January 29th, after finding John, Karen noticed her vehicle had a smashed rear taillight, pieces of which were later found at the scene. Jen McCabe told investigators that Karen mentioned the broken taillight more than once, first over the phone and again in person that morning. In other words, Jen McCabe's story is that Karen herself brought up the shattered taillight while they were searching for John. Jen McCabe testified that she described the taillight to police as cracked and missing pieces, and she claimed that she had been consistent in that description every time. The defense's implication here is that Jen McCabe might have been overemphasizing the broken light, which is key physical evidence, or that her description changed over time. But Jen McCabe insisted nothing changed. The taillight was broken, and she relayed exactly that. In fact, on Friday, during a particularly fiery exchange, Jen McCabe blurted out that she wasn't concerned about anyone inside the house being harmed because all the focus was on Karen, saying, quote, "Your client was screaming, she hit him. She had a cracked taillight. She was crying, she hit him," end quote. And Alan Jackson pounced on that, saying, "You had solved the crime right then and there. You solved the whole case." And Jen McCabe replied, "No, I didn't," explaining that she simply knew John never made it inside the house, so she wasn't worried about any danger inside of the house. Her mind was already forming the theory that Karen hit him outside. And this exchange was revealing. It showed that Jen McCabe's mindset at the scene was that she immediately suspected Karen due to the taillight and Karen's own hysteria. And it let the defense imply that Jen McCabe solved the case a bit too quickly, perhaps seeing what she wanted to see. Because Alan Jackson was really hammering down on Jen McCabe, asking why she never went into her sister's house, why she never went to go check if they were okay, to see why they weren't answering any calls, or, you know, if anything had happened to Brian either. He really made it a point to say that with everything going on in the yard and people not answering in the house, why wouldn't you go inside the house? Why wouldn't anybody go inside the house when there's a dead man in the front yard? Records showed that Jen McCabe placed a call to her sister, Nicole Albert, at 5:07 a.m. on January 29th. Now, this is roughly an hour before John was found, which was around 6:10 a.m. So Alan Jackson asked why Jen McCabe called Nicole at that hour. Was she alerting her sister that something was wrong before they even discovered John? Jen McCabe kind of downplayed this. She admitted calling Nicole, but said it was not to alert her to anything nefarious. Essentially, she suggested that it was innocent, perhaps related to picking up Nicole's kids or preparing to search for John, though she didn't specify in her testimony. The defense implied that this 5 a.m. call might have been a heads up to the Alberts that something bad had happened to John, which would only make sense if Jen McCabe already knew or suspected it. Again, a subtle insinuation that Jen McCabe knew more than she should have at that time. But some of the most eyebrow-raising evidence introduced on Friday was a family group text chat between Jen McCabe, her husband Matt McCabe, her sister Nicole, and her brother-in-law Brian Albert. As the morning of January 29th unfolded and police began investigating John's death, Jen and her family were texting among themselves about what was happening in real time. In one text, as Jen McCabe and others were listening to their friend Carrie Roberts give an interview to police, Jen McCabe messaged the group saying, quote, "She is telling them everything." And everything was in all caps, to which she later added, "I love it." She was effectively providing play-by-play of Carrie cooperating with the cops. Other texts from February 1st showed family members discussing news reporters poking around, and one of Jen McCabe's relatives wrote, quote, "Tell them the guy never went in the house," end quote, referring to John O'Keefe. "Exactly," Brian Albert replied. In another, Jen McCabe's husband, Matt, referring to Karen Reed, said, quote, "If she pleads out, it will end. If she fights it, it will be an episode." Now, these texts make it sound like the family was very much aligning their narrative, saying the guy never went in the house. First of all, if he was such a close friend of yours and you all cared so deeply about him, why do you say the guy never went in the house? Like, that just seems very insensitive and detached from the seriousness of this. Alan Jackson used these messages to argue that Jen McCabe and her family were coordinating their versions of events, essentially colluding to ensure that everyone told the same story that exculpated everyone inside the house that night. At one point, he suggested that this was damage control and even accused Jen McCabe on the stand of witness collusion. Jen McCabe defended herself, saying that there was nothing nefarious about those texts. She claimed that they were just shocked family members trying to figure out what happened and sharing updates. She testified that she and her relatives were not inventing a story, but rather reacting to live information, saying, quote, "We were just reporting what we saw." For example, when she texted, "I love it," as Carrie was telling everything to police, Jen McCabe, she said that she loved that Carrie was being so candid because in Jen McCabe's view, they had nothing to hide. Still, from the defense perspective, those texts were a goldmine to cast suspicion. They show the inner workings of a group of friends and family immediately after the incident, and the defense spun it as a cover-up in progress, with Jen McCabe as the central communicator. This is exactly why Reed's team called McCabe the quarterback. It was really compelling to hear these private messages read out loud, and I want to know your thoughts on this, if you think that these text messages are very telling, and how you might react in if you were in Jen McCabe's shoes but had absolutely nothing to hide. Like, if you really were innocent, are these the kind of text messages that you would be sending your friends and family after your dear friend was just found dying and eventually died in the front yard? I certainly can't imagine a close family friend, or even just any friend for that matter, referring to them so coldly like that. I think it is very telling. Next on Friday, Alan Jackson brought up an event from the day after John O'Keefe's death. On January 30th, data shows that Jen McCabe's cell phone, and presumably Jen herself, went to the home of Michael Lank, a relative or acquaintance who was somehow involved in giving Carrie Roberts' daughter a ride that weekend. Jen McCabe had previously given differing accounts about this errand. On one occasion, she said that she went to Lank's to drop off Carrie's daughter. On another, she said that she went to pick up the child. So which was it? On Friday, Jen McCabe admitted that her recollection was fuzzy. Clearly, her testimony about Lank's was conflicting. What is clear is that GPS data showed her making stops at Michael Lank's house and even sitting in her car outside that house for 45 minutes on January 30th. The defense found this fishy. Why park for 45 minutes on what should have been a quick child pickup or drop-off? They hinted that maybe Jen McCabe met with someone or did something related to the case during that period, perhaps discussing stories or even handling evidence. Jen McCabe didn't offer much of an explanation beyond the benign errand. And to the jurors, it was another lingering question mark planted by the defense, a hint that something was up with McCabe's activities in the immediate aftermath of the incident. Because you have to remember, Michael Lank, I'm not sure if I mentioned this or not, but Michael Lank worked for the police department. So he's not just a random neighbor or a family friend. He actually has ties to people involved in this case. Now, finally, the defense touched on Jen McCabe's interactions with Trooper Michael Proctor, this Massachusetts State Police investigator assigned to the case, who, side note, was later fired for unrelated misconduct in this very case. Alan Jackson asked Jen McCabe about when she met or communicated with Trooper Proctor. Initially, Jen said that she didn't know Proctor personally until 2023, well after John's death, but phone records and testimony suggested that she had multiple calls with Proctor much earlier during the investigation. Under cross, Jen McCabe had to walk back her prior statement. She conceded that she had talked to Proctor before, possibly in 2022, though when interviewed by another officer, Lieutenant Tully, about it, her answers were unclear regarding the extent of her relationship with Trooper Proctor. The defense implied that Proctor and McCabe might have been in cahoots, or at least that McCabe had an unusual level of access to the lead investigator, which could feed into the cover-up narrative. Jen McCabe didn't admit to anything improper, but the mere fact that she had to correct herself on when she met Michael Proctor gave the defense one more inconsistency to point to. After this exhaustive cross-examination, which spanned 3 days in total, McCabe was understandably worn down, and likely the jurors were too. But before she stepped down, the prosecution, Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan, had a chance to do a redirect examination to rehabilitate her credibility a bit. His strategy was interesting. He leaned into Jed McCabe's emotional state and the trauma of that morning to remind the jury that she went through something harrowing, and also to subtly counter the defense's timeline attacks. At one point, noting that Jen McCabe wears an Apple Watch daily, Brennan asked her how she felt physically and emotionally after they found John O'Keefe in the snow. She described herself as, quote, extremely nervous, anxious, scared, uncertain, panicked, end quote, in that moment. She agreed that her heart rate would have been sky high, something her Apple Watch's heart monitor would likely reflect if we had the data. And then he drew a contrast. He asked Miss McCabe how she was feeling earlier that same morning, hours before the discovery, when she was back home around 2 or 2:30. And she said that earlier at that time, she was relaxed, just playing on my phone, looking up youth sports and things before she went to bed. Her heart rate would have been normal then, and she was calm. And this line of questioning may have seemed odd at first, but it had a purpose, because Hank Brennan was subtly reinforcing the idea that Jed McCabe was only panicked after finding John, not in the middle of the night. If she was calm at 2:27 a.m., it fits the idea that she had no idea that John was dying, hence she wouldn't be frantically Googling anything yet. Only after 6 a.m., when the crisis hit, did she actually freak out. It's a small detail, but by using the Apple Watch reference, Brennan gave the jury a relatable picture of McCabe's heart rate timeline, calm during the alleged 2:27 search time, and then spiking later on. So this was aimed to bolster her version of the timing, that the cold weather Google search happened later when she was in panic mode. Brennan also allowed Jen McCabe to emphasize that she had tried to cooperate fully with law enforcement from the start. Jen McCabe testified that she never intentionally held anything back from police. Yes, she misremembered some phone calls and had lapses, but she insisted that she never lied or attempted to deceive investigators about what happened. In fact, when asked about the ordeal that she's been through, she said that it's been hell, that she's been harassed and maligned for 2 years as this supposed conspirator, all while dealing with the trauma of losing a close friend in such a horrific way. Some texts that Hank Brennan presented to the jury underscored her genuine distress. In one text to a friend after John O'Keefe's death, Jen McCabe wrote, quote, "My mind is racing. I have that awful feeling in my gut, like I'm about to puke, trying to wrap my head around what happened to him," end quote. In another, she described seeing John's image every time she closed her eyes and feeling physically ill at the thought of him lying in the snow. These were not texts meant for public eyes, just in private messages, which lends them some credibility. However, if you're on the defense, you might point out that if your mind is racing and you have this awful feeling in your gut like you're about to puke and you're trying to wrap your head around what happened to him, it might indicate a guilty conscience knowing that something horrible happened to him and you have guilt about it. As Jen McCabe left the stand, Karen Reed's attorney Alan Jackson quipped that nobody has been in the hot seat longer than she has so far in this trial, and he's right. Jen McCabe's testimony spanned parts of 3 days, making her one of the most significant and heavily scrutinized witnesses yet. Now the jury is left to digest all of this, the late night phone calls, the contested Google search, the group text, the changed timelines, and that alleged confession in the snow. It's a lot to unpack. But with that, we will now move on to the events of Monday, May 5th.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
On Monday, May 5th, the week kicked off with a whirlwind of witnesses, six in one day. Several witnesses or friends who were at the Keaton house party that night testified about the late night timeline. Hannah Maxson and Ryan Nagel recalled seeing Karen Reed's black Lexus SUV around 1:30 a.m. as they arrived and left the gathering. And crucially, they said they only ever saw one person in the SUV, which was Karen, during those moments. Maxson remembered glimpsing a man in the passenger seat when they first pulled up, but by the time they drove off a few minutes later, there was only a woman in the driver's seat. Neither saw anyone stumble around in the front yard or anything unusual as they departed. Another friend, identified as Levinson, testified that she left the house around 1:30 a.m. along with Jennifer and Matthew McCabe. And in a pointed detail, Levinson noted police didn't even interview her about that night until October of 2022, a full 9 months later, suggesting possible gaps in the early investigation that the defense was happy to highlight. I also just have to comment on the fact that these witnesses, who are pretty removed, like they're not really in the inner circle as you would consider, like Jen and Matt McCabe or the Alberts or even Brian Higgins, like Carrie Roberts, they're removed from that inner circle. So the fact that they are saying, yeah, we were outside, we saw Karen Reed's SUV, we saw Karen sitting in the front seat, but we never saw John, bolsters that John actually did go inside the house at some point that night, because they didn't see John. So where would he have been? I think that is a huge and crucial detail that I hope really sticks with the jury. But the star witness Monday was Canton firefighter paramedic Katie McLaughlin, one of the first responders on the scene. Her testimony delivered a bombshell. She said that in the frantic moments after John O'Keefe's body was found in the snow, that Karen blurted out, I hit him, multiple times. This allegedly happened as McLaughlin was trying to get information from Karen about what led up to John O'Keefe's injuries. McLaughlin testified that she asked if any significant trauma preceded finding John, and that Karen responded with a series of panicked statements, I hit him, repeated four times. That quote hung in the courtroom air. It's about as dramatic as it gets, essentially an apparent confession, or at least Karen fearing that she had hit him. An officer on scene even immediately waved over a supervisor upon hearing it. Now, Katie didn't press Karen further in that moment. She said that the situation was highly emotional and that it wasn't the right time to demand clarification. Notably, key prosecution witness Jen McCabe, who was with Karen that morning, corroborated this detail in her own prior testimony, saying that she too heard Karen say, I hit him, as they were standing by John's body. So now the jury has heard that alleged quote from two different people. However, I think it's worth noting that multiple people also have said that Karen said, could I have hit him? Could I have hit him? And so, in my opinion, I just feel like these people who are saying they heard her say I hit him are probably getting it confused, or they're expanding on her quote of could I have hit him to just say I hit him, because it better fits their narrative. Now, on cross-examination, defense attorney Alan Jackson aggressively questioned Katie's objectivity. He zeroed in on the fact that Katie McLaughlin knew the homeowners. Specifically, she went to high school with Brian Albert's daughter, Caitlin. Katie admitted that she and Caitlin Albert have crossed paths socially for years, but she insisted that they're just acquaintances and not close friends. When Alan Jackson pressed why Katie hadn't disclosed that connection in the first trial until after the internet harassment started, the exchange really grew tense, and at one point, Alan challenged her memory and honesty, to which Katie snapped back, I don't think you understand, effectively pushing back at his insinuations, because they kept going back and forth with these questions
where Alan Jackson would say, "Do you understand what I'm saying?" And she said, "I don't think you understand what I'm saying." But that bit of sass from a paramedic on the stand in defense of her own credibility brought a noticeable crackle to the courtroom. It was this true crime podcast worthy moment. You could almost hear like a ooh from the gallery as the professional first responder stood her ground against the defense lawyer. And I have to imagine that she has been probably like brought through the ringer regarding this whole trial. I mean, people have been harassing her online, pointing out that there are pictures of her and Caitlin together, despite her saying that they're not friends. But Katie also testified that she never took written notes about Karen's statements, other than scribbling John's vitals on her glove. But she calmly noted that she won't ever forget those statements, referring to Karen saying, "I hit him." So, you know, whatever. Do with that what you will. I would like to hear what you guys think about Katie's testimony, if you think that she is a little bit biased because she happens to have these connections to the Albert family, or if she really is only operating in a professional capacity as a first responder. Now, retired Canton Police Lieutenant Paul Gallagher also testified on Monday, providing the jury with a picture of the early crime scene processing. Gallagher was on site the morning that John's body was found, and he literally took a leaf blower to the snow to reveal evidence. Yes, a leaf blower. That's how fast the snow was coming down, apparently. He uncovered a few important items, notably a broken cocktail glass in the snow where John was laying. And Gallagher said that he carefully handed that glass off to another officer and then didn't see it again until later when it was in the forensic unit. He also recalled that the weather was deteriorating so rapidly that the snow was quickly piling up at the scene, potentially burying evidence as fast as they could find it. On redirect, Gallagher confirmed a couple key points for the prosecution. No witness ever indicated John O'Keefe got into a fight that night, so those injuries couldn't be explained by a brawl. However, that could also just mean that nobody is admitting to it, because hence that is the entire premise of a cover-up. But Gallagher's testimony also revealed the initial search of the yard was somewhat limited. The focus was around the body and the immediate area. He noted that they didn't search all the way from the yard's flagpole to the house, for instance, raising questions about whether everything was found that night, because they didn't even go inside the house. They never stepped foot inside the house, despite there being a party that went into the early morning hours just the night before that John was supposed to be attending. Why wouldn't you search the house? But this would later become a point of contention in the trial. By day's end on Monday, the jury had a lot to chew on. The mood in the court was intense. We had emotional testimony and combative cross-examinations all in one go. The "I hit him" quote was on headlines everywhere by that evening. Media outlets described McLaughlin's testimony as a pivotal moment, and true crime commentators were already debating, did Karen literally mean she struck John with her car, or was she in shock and blaming herself without knowing what happened? Either way, it set the stage for the week, and let's go ahead and move on to Tuesday, May 7th. If Monday brought the drama, Tuesday brought the data and some equally dramatic audio evidence. Massachusetts State Police Trooper Nick Guarino took the stand and walked the court through a deep dive of phone records and communications between Karen and John. The prosecution played a series of Karen's voicemails to John from the early morning hours of January 29th, and they were as explosive as advertised. In one message left at 12:37 a.m., a furious Karen can be heard yelling, "John, I fucking hate you," expletives and all, into John's voicemail. In another, she's ranting, "I'm here with your fucking kids and nobody knows what the fuck you want, you fucking pervert," accusing John of ditching her to be with another woman. Now, I came across this TikTok video, and I know it sounds crazy, okay? But I'm going to play this video for you because I do think it's just interesting. And take this video with a grain of salt, but I do just find the information to be intriguing. So let me know your thoughts on it, but I'm going to go ahead and play it for you now.
South Shore or south of Boston native. I'm from two towns over from Canton. I have multiple Boston police officers and other town police officers in my family, including Boston police and my immediate family. Everyone I know thinks Karen is innocent, and that's saying a lot. Also, my hair salon, which I get the best gossip from, everyone knows that crew is swapping, and that's why Karen felt uncomfortable going to the house. She's like, if that nonsense is going on, I'm not going in. John, go check it out. And that's why she called him a pervert, obviously.
So it's an interesting theory, albeit it's a bit of a stretch maybe for some, but I do think it kind of adds context and maybe makes that make a little more sense why she would be calling him an effing pervert. Karen actually called John 52 times that night between midnight and 6 a.m., 52 times, and left about 8 voicemails full of rage, confusion, and increasingly desperate profanity. By the 3rd or 4th voicemail, her language was off the charts, calling him a loser and worse, indicating that she was really spiraling emotionally as the night wore on. But I want you to ask yourself this question. If she knew that she hit John or had any inclination that she hit John, whether she meant to or did it accidentally, do you think she would be calling him 52 times? Or do you think that if she had any kind of inkling that she hit him, she would just go back right then and check on him rather than call him 52 times and leave all these voicemails? I know that some people might think, you know, if they are of the team that believes that Karen is guilty, they think that maybe she was leaving these voicemails and calling to establish an alibi. And we've seen that play out with cases like Chris Watts or Scott Peterson, when after they've killed their wife, they go and, you know, text or leave voicemails and are like, oh, where are you? We're trying to look for you, trying to find you, love you, and acting all sweet and stuff. That is obviously not the case here. Karen is calling him and shouting these horrific insults at him. Do you think that that would be, you know, conducive to establishing an alibi? I don't, but, you know, if you disagree, let me know what you think. Now, the final voicemail Karen left was at 6:03 a.m., literally as John's body was being discovered outside the house. And in that recording, her tone shifts from anger to panic. You can hear some commotion in the background. There's a woman's voice who is likely Jen McCabe giving John's information to a 911 operator. And Karen is screaming for someone named Carrie, which we now know as Carrie Roberts. It's really a chilling scene because it captures the exact moment that the tragedy really came to light. Gorina's testimony about this call noted that Karen's very last attempt to reach John coincided with the discovery moment, suggesting that she was still trying to find him, not knowing that he was yards away in the snow. Now, one observer, a defense-leaning legal analyst, commented that these voicemails actually painted Karen more as a frantic, worried girlfriend who didn't know John was dead. Essentially, she sounds genuinely frantic and clueless about where he is and what happened to him. But from a prosecution standpoint, the voicemails also show Karen's mindset that she was livid and possibly intoxicated given her vulgar language, which might have led to reckless driving. Regardless, hearing those recordings was a pretty humanizing moment. And I think it begs us to remind ourselves that these are real people that we're talking about. These are real events that happened to real people. I sometimes get lost in just like the analytics of a case and the logic and reasoning behind a case. And sometimes I think it's easy to forget that there are people who are traumatized by all of this and actually lived it. So next, the focus shifted to physical evidence. State Police Lieutenant Kevin O'Hara led the special emergency response team search of the yard that morning on January 29th, and he testified about what they found, namely a trail of red plastic shards and a sneaker. O'Hara described how his team lined up and did a grid search of the snow-covered front lawn and driveway. Around 5:45 p.m. that day, they started finding pieces of a broken taillight in the snow. By the time they paused the search, they had collected over 40 bits of red plastic, all scattered near the area where John had been found. Photographs of these jagged red fragments were shown to the jury, implicitly linking them to the busted rear taillight on Karen's SUV. O'Hara also confirmed that one of John O'Keefe's black sneakers was discovered in the yard outside by the CERT team. When John had been found with only one shoe on, and investigators theorized early on that a forceful vehicle impact knocked the other shoe off. The old, like, knocked him out of a shoe scenario. It's not uncommon for someone who's hit by a car to actually fly out of their shoes or lose their shoes in the process. So O'Hara actually admitted that as soon as he learned one shoe was missing, he suspected a car strike was involved, fitting their working theory that night. This physical evidence, the shoe and the constellation of taillight pieces, strongly bolsters the prosecution's claim that Karen's Lexus hit John in the driveway.
Importantly, O'Hara testified about who was and was not present during the search. He noted that none of the Canton police officers at the scene participated in or interfered with the state police grid. In fact, two figures under scrutiny, Trooper Michael Proctor, the lead investigator who has since been fired, and Sergeant Yuri Bukenik, which is Proctor's supervisor, were not at the scene at all while O'Hara's team was collecting evidence. O'Hara emphasized that he saw no one planting or tossing anything into the search area. Everything they found legitimately where it lay. This was likely aimed at countering the defense's insinuations that evidence, like those taillight pieces, might have been planted later. O'Hara even testified that he offered to come back another day to continue searching if needed, but they were never asked to return. Now, regarding him saying that Bukenik and Proctor weren't there and that, you know, he never saw anybody plant any evidence, you know, this search took place later in the afternoon. Almost an entire day had passed. You know, he was found, John O'Keefe was found at 6 a.m. This search is happening that same evening. There's hours that have passed. So just because he says he didn't see anyone plant evidence or he says Trooper Proctor or Sergeant Bukenik weren't there doesn't mean that they weren't there at some other point. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt like you do with everything in this case. But one curious anecdote from O'Hara's testimony was when he said that when his search team first arrived at the house the night of January 29th, a man in a hooded sweatshirt came out of the house and asked them, "Are you here for what happened earlier?" O'Hara replied, "Yes," and that man promptly went back inside without identifying himself. O'Hara didn't know who it was, leaving everyone wondering if it might have been someone from the party, perhaps the homeowner or another guest, essentially tipping them off. It was a little mysterious aside that probably caught the jury's attention and the defense's, who might argue that it could have been someone involved in the altercation with John. And I think it's worth noting that there is surveillance footage from the night of the party that showed Brian Higgins after the party walking around the police station at like 1:45 in the morning, I think it was, and he's wearing a hooded sweatshirt with the hood up, and it's a dark black hooded sweatshirt. So it could have been him, but that's just speculation. Now, to round out Tuesday, the prosecution called Robert Gilman, a meteorologist, to testify about the weather, a seemingly mundane topic that turned out to be quite relevant. Gilman provided a timeline of the snowstorm's intensity that evening. He said that in the early hours of January 29th, Canton was in the throes of a classic New England blizzard. By 1 a.m., only about half an inch of snow had accumulated, but by 4 a.m. and onward, it was dumping snow heavily. In total, nearly 2 feet of snow fell from that storm, with fierce wind gusts up to 47 miles per hour that made the wind chill feel around 0 degrees Fahrenheit, like literal snowstorm conditions. The jury got to hear terms like whiteout conditions and learned that by midday on January 29th, over a foot of snow had piled up on the ground. Now, why does this matter? Well, it speaks to John's cause of death. Hypothermia was a major factor. The actual cause was blunt force trauma to the head and hypothermia, but hypothermia was a major factor. And to why evidence was hard to find, because things got buried fast, and it helps explain why none of the partygoers saw John's body earlier. Gilman explained that at 1 a.m., visibility in light snow would have been about 1.25 miles, which is not terrible, but certainly dark and snowy enough that a body prone in the yard could be easily overlooked in the dark. By the time heavy snow and plowing happened, a person could be completely covered, and this scientific context supported both the prosecution's timeline, that John likely lay there all night through the storm, and then countered any defense suggestion that someone would have seen him earlier. But I will say, I have seen a video of someone driving that same corner and that same street at night, as if to pull out of the driveway and like kind of curve and see the flagpole. So the way that this car was driving, it was set as an example of exactly what somebody might have been seeing that same night in similar conditions. And when the lights pan over the front yard and the flagpole, it would be really hard to not see that somebody is laying in the ground. Even if there's a little dusting of snow, I think the contrast of the snow and an actual body in the snow would be pretty obvious to see. So regardless of this meteorologist's testimony, I still have doubts that somebody would miss seeing a body laying in the snow that night. And with that, let's move on to Wednesday, May 8th. Digital forensics took center stage on Wednesday as the trial shifted into high-tech mode, though not without a few old-fashioned courtroom hiccups. The star witness was Jessica Hyde, a digital forensics expert who came armed with data to clarify the timing of a much-debated Google search. The defense had actually tried to keep Hyde off the stand, which only heightened the anticipation for what she would say. If I'm being honest and kind of judgmental, Jessica Hyde really bugs the shit out of me. I don't know why. If you guys are watching live or have seen clips of her, it appears that she has dreadlocks and she keeps them covered with like a head wrap. But the way that she talks is so condescending and pretentious and just, I don't know. She seems like she thinks that she is the smartest person in the room. And some of her answers were just really kind of cringy to watch. I'll just play some clips so that you can kind of get a taste of what she was like on the stand. And if I'm totally off base, then I'm off base. You can call me judgmental or whatever, but I didn't like her. So here's some clips so that you can get a taste.
Kind of explain it. So let's say we're in a restaurant and we're sitting at a table and we're ordering food. Our table is the table. Data is going to come to the table and that's going to be our food. So when we order food, let's say we've got a chicken sandwich, a burger, and a pizza coming to the table. The chicken sandwich, the burger, and the pizza, the kitchen puts it in the warming area. It's the write-ahead log. The server grabs it from there. It's where data sits before it goes to the table, just like your food goes to that serving station before your server brings it to your table. Server brings it to the table. That table's got its burger, its chicken, and its pizza. Another table orders waffles and pancakes. They think it's breakfast. The waffles and pancakes are made by the kitchen. They're put on the serving area. Waitress comes over. This pizza has pepperoni. I don't eat pepperoni. Can you send it back? Waitress picks up that pepperoni and sends it back. That's a deletion. Pepperoni pizza was just removed from the table, right? We're deleting it. We said it's not what we wanted. The waitress is removing it. She brings it back to that serving area. At that moment, that serving area has the deleted pizza, but also the waffles and pancakes that are waiting to go out to the table. That's how a write-ahead log works. Any changes that are happening sit in the write-ahead log until the database is closed, and then when it's reopened, all those changes are made, both additions and deletions. So often when a phone is in, the database knows to read it to you in its current state. So it tells you where the waffles and pancakes are going. They're going to that table. So it shows it as if it's in the table. But it's not in the table yet. So if when we parse the data and we look at the restaurant and we don't look at the back kitchen, we would only at that time see the chicken and the burger, right? Pizza got sent back. Waffles and pancakes haven't come out yet. So when we get the data, we get two files. We get the restaurant, that's the database, and we get the serving area, that's the wall file.
So that clip that you've just heard is Jessica Hyde trying to explain to the jury basically how she does her job. And if you are confused, so am I, and so is probably the jury. Some of my favorite comments that people left regarding that piece of testimony was, so Jen ordered her food at 2:27 a.m. then? We're all confused. Someone said, hoss long till food is cold. These are just funny comments. I think sometimes comments really make the best part of the video. But all of this is to say that if the defense was worried about Jessica Hyde testifying and tried to keep her off the stand, I actually think now they're probably glad that she took the stand, because obviously she just made things so much more confusing. And I think it's worth noting that a Maryland court found this woman's expert testimony and methodology unreliable. So I don't even know why, what made her reliable for this trial, but she is basically the CEO, the creator of this data company that she works for and is testifying for. So I don't know. I thought she was kind of a big waste of time, but her appearance followed up on the tail end of Trooper Guarino's testimony about phone records, which continued Wednesday morning. Guarino had already covered Karen's call calls. On Wednesday, he also touched on other data like text messages involving Jen McCabe and even John O'Keefe's niece's phone to just establish who was contacting who that night. And this set the stage for Hyde by putting all the digital breadcrumbs on the table. All in all, Wednesday morning was like a crash course in digital forensics for the jury. Not the most thrilling TV drama stuff, but essential for parsing the timeline. And given how central the Google search at 2:27 a.m. theory has been in online discussions of the case, Hyde's clarification was a significant moment for some people who believe that Karen Reed is guilty, or that, or for people who believe that Jen McCabe made that search at 2:27 a.m. because she is also, you know, bolstering the prosecution's theory that the search was not made at 2:27 a.m. But Wednesday was not all data. We also had a brief burst of old school courtroom drama due to an evidence mix-up. For the second day in a row, proceedings were interrupted by confusion over John O'Keefe's sneakers. So here's what happened. On Tuesday, a trooper had shown the jury one of John's sneakers that was recovered from the scene, which was the one that was found in the yard. On Wednesday, Sergeant Buchanick, who hadn't testified yet but was helping present evidence, went to display the other sneaker, the one that had remained on John's foot and was later taken at the hospital. And as Buchanick examined the evidence bag in court, he suddenly looked confused and announced that the bag's label indicated it was the right sneaker from 34 Fairview. Which didn't make sense because only one shoe, which was the left one, was found at 34 Fairview. In other words, both the sneaker from the yard and the sneaker from the hospital somehow had paperwork labeling as if they came from the same scene. Cue the confusion. The judge literally had to call a recess to sort out what was what. It turned out to be an administrative error. The sneaker that Buchanick had was indeed the one removed from John at the hospital, but it had apparently been mislabeled in evidence handling. And I'm sure the defense was just sitting there thrilled on the inside because their entire goal for this trial is to point out just how incompetent the investigation and the people leading it have been. And I'm sure Wednesday felt like a whole lot of wins to bolster that theory. The whole sneaker snafu, minor as it was, gave the defense more ammo to suggest disorganization in the investigation. And it definitely injected some momentary levity and eye rolls into the day. But after that all resolved, Wednesday continued smoothly. By mid-afternoon, Judge Cannone adjourned for the day, noting that the trial was still moving ahead of schedule. Outside the courthouse, legal pundits were buzzing about Hyde's testimony. Was the how long to die in cold search timestamp debate finally put to bed? It certainly looked like the prosecution had scored a win on that point, according to them. But on the other hand, the defense had spent 3 days hammering at the investigative missteps, and the shoe mix-up kind of underscored that theme, even if it was minor. But the public reaction midweek was split. Karen Reed's supporters, who have been very vocal online and outside court, downplayed Jessica Hyde's testimony, doubling down on their belief that something fishy happened with phone evidence timing. Meanwhile, many observers found that Hyde was credible and felt this trial was not the conspiracy narrative that some initially thought it was. So the stage was set for a critical end of week. The prosecution was wrapping up its case and anticipation was building to see how the defense would counter all of this in the coming days. So with that, let's move on to Thursday, May 9th.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe, discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max Bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And The Epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max Bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Thursday's session was essentially the Yuri Bukenik show, as this Massachusetts State Police sergeant spent the entire day on the witness stand. Sergeant Yuri Bukenik was the supervisor of Trooper Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, and his testimony was a mix of narrative storytelling, evidence demonstration, and a healthy dose of cross-examination fireworks. In a way, Bukenik served as a capstone witness for the prosecution's case in chief, walking jurors through the investigation's timeline and then fending off attacks from the defense about alleged police misconduct. On direct examination, Bukenik started from the top. He got a phone call at around 6:44 a.m. on January 29th, alerting him that a man had been found in a snowbank in Canton. He testified that he immediately contacted Trooper Proctor, who was on call that morning, and told him to head to the scene to follow up. They essentially kicked into investigation mode right away. Within a few hours, Bukenik and Proctor convened at the Canton Police Department around 9:15 a.m. to start gathering evidence and info. Yuri Bukenik described seeing John O'Keefe's cell phone, a broken cocktail glass, and a brown paper bag containing Solo cups with what looked like blood in them, all items that had been collected from the front yard at 34 Fairview earlier that morning. He also noted that they had already heard that Karen was questioning whether she might have hit John, and that detail came in through officers at the scene, presumably from McLaughlin or others relaying Karen's "I hit him" statements. However, Yuri said that at that stage, they were in fact-finding mode and not yet drawing conclusions. From Canton PD, Bukenik and Proctor then split up their tasks. They went in to interview people who had been at the house. Bukenik testified that they spoke with Brian Albert, the homeowner, and a Boston police officer himself, and his relatives Jennifer and Matthew McCabe that morning. We didn't get a full rundown of what those three told them. That wasn't the focus on Thursday, but presumably they got the basic story. John and Karen came to the after party. John was assumed to have left or gone missing and then was found outside. After those interviews, Bukenik and Proctor headed to Good Samaritan Medical Center, where John O'Keefe had been taken, to examine John's body and collect evidence from it. Bukenik's description of John's condition was somber and a bit graphic, but John had blood pooled under his head, swollen and discolored eyelids, a small cut near one of his eyelids, a laceration on the side of his nose, an abrasion on his right knee, and a series of cuts and bruises on the outside of his right arm. However, I want to emphasize that these aren't just cuts and bruises on his arm. They are huge lacerations. And I can post them to the Instagram if you want, or you can just Google them if you'd like to see them for yourself. But these injuries, to me, do not indicate being hit by a car. They don't suggest that at all to me. But Bukenik on the stand said that he had already had them suspecting some kind of vehicle strike because they weren't typical of just laying in the snow. The head trauma and pattern of injuries suggested an impact, in his opinion. He also noted that John was soaking wet from lying in the snow and that one of John's sneakers was missing. And that missing shoe set off alarm bells, as Bukenik put it on the stand, saying by then their theory had evolved to a vehicle strike. And he even speculated in that moment that John was hit out of his shoes. But this comment was important because it shows that even before a full investigation, the police were zeroing in on a car accident theory. And indeed, Yuri Bukenik testified that he thought the missing sneaker would likely be found at the scene of the impact. Sure enough, he later learned that the search and rescue team did find a matching Nike sneaker outside of 34 Fairview in the snow, confirming his hunch. But man, I look at those pictures. I just looked at them again. I just looked them up to kind of refresh my memory. They do not look like the injuries that would be sustained by someone backing into a person. They just simply don't. And I think at the end of the day, regardless of the Haas Long to die in cold search or any kind of text messages or digital theories or whatever, you cannot expect me to believe that the injuries John O'Keefe sustained were from being backed into by a vehicle at a high rate of speed in reverse on a snowy night. Like it just does not make sense. For me, regardless of literally any other evidence, that is the one thing that sticks out the most to me are just his injuries. But after they went to the hospital, Buchanek and Proctor went to speak with Karen Reed herself. They drove down to Karen's parents' house in Dighton, Massachusetts, arriving around 3 p.m. on January 29th to interview her. According to Buchanek's testimony, Karen was cooperative and voluntarily spoke with them, but she was also cautious. She said that she was willing to answer questions, but didn't want to get into too many details. Still, she recounted her version of the night before, that she and John had met up at a bar, C.F. McCarthy's, on Friday evening, where she drank vodka sodas and John had Bud Lights. They later went to another bar, the Waterfall, for a bit, and then they headed to the after party at 34 Fairview. Karen told the investigators that when she dropped John off in front of the house, she performed a three-point turn in the cul-de-sac and left, not seeing John actually go inside. And this is important because she's maintained that she last saw John alive outside the house and assumed he went in, but didn't physically witness it. Notably, just after this trial day, Karen would tell reporters the same thing defiantly, saying, quote, "I saw John go into the house," doubling down on that claim. According to Yuri, Karen also mentioned something kind of random, that John had bumped his head two nights earlier on January 27th, but she didn't see any injuries on him on the 28th. So perhaps she was preemptively explaining any head injury he had as not from her. But in any case, Buchanek and Proctor didn't detain Karen then. They took her cell phone and arranged for her Lexus SUV to be towed for examination. But they left her home after the interview. And at that point, Karen was not under arrest. She was cooperative, even if she was kind of a suspect at that point. Now, that was the narrative that Yuri Buchanek delivered on direct, basically a timeline of the investigation's first day, showing that police followed a logical trail from the scene to witnesses to hospital to suspect. But the real action on Thursday came when defense attorney Alan Jackson began his cross-examination of Yuri Buchanek, and this is where the tone shifted to confrontational. Jackson's mission was clear: implicate Buchanek and Proctor in a sloppy or biased investigation to support the defense theory that Karen is being framed, or at least that the investigation was riddled with errors, as the defense has claimed. So Jackson first probed the division of labor and chain of command between Buchanek and Proctor. Essentially, he wanted to highlight that Proctor had a significant, perhaps outsized, role in handling evidence. Buchanek acknowledged that Proctor played a more major role than other troopers in this case, but he wouldn't concede that anything improper had happened. Jackson then zeroed in on those controversial text messages that Proctor was called out for in the first trial. And during a direct examination, the prosecution itself had Buchanek read some of Proctor's crude texts aloud, like one that wrote, quote, "Funny, I am going through his retarded client's phone." And in another saying, quote, "No nudes so far. I hate that man. I truly hate him," end quote. Now, the retarded client comment was presumably a slur referring to one of Karen's lawyers or someone defending her, which I believe it was actually about David Yannetti, because there was also a screenshot that showed David Yannetti's face with a caption. It looked like someone took this picture of a TV screen that was likely covering the story that announced that David Yannetti was going to be on the defense team for Karen Reed. So this screenshot or picture of the TV was sent in this group text, and then Michael Proctor wrote in response, "Funny, I'm going through his retarded client's phone. No nudes so far. I hate that man. I truly hate him." I think he's saying he hates David Yannetti. But anyway, it's obviously highly unprofessional and offensive, and Yuri Buchanek had to admit that he was a part of that text group, though he claimed he didn't author those particular messages or even remember him saying that, despite it being right in front of his face. In fact, Yuri got disciplined internally for not reining Proctor in when those texts came to light, and he had to give up 5 vacation days as punishment, you guys, a whole 5 days. But the defense likely scored some points here, painting a picture of investigators who were mocking the defendant behind the scenes. It's obviously not a good look and might sow doubt about their objectivity. And Yuri Buchanek, for his part, tried to mitigate the damage by saying that he just acknowledged Proctor's inappropriate text with the thumbs up emoji at the time instead of reporting it, which is not exactly a strong defense, but he owned that he failed to reprimand his subordinate. So I think he liked the message. You know how you can react to a text? I think that's what he did, rather than actually send a thumbs up emoji. But Jackson also attacked how evidence was handled by Proctor after the initial search. A dramatic moment came when the defense put up photos of evidence bags on the courtroom monitor showing additional taillight fragments that Proctor collected on February 11th, nearly 2 weeks after John's death. One large red piece of plastic, about 6 inches wide, was logged by Proctor on February 11th. Another batch of several pieces was collected by Proctor a week after that on February 18th, including yet another big chunk of red lens around 6 inches wide. Buchanick confirmed those dates and finds, and then Jackson did the obvious. He asked Buchanick if those pieces were so large, wouldn't O'Hara's team have found them during the search on January 29th? But Buchanick admitted, saying, quote, "If I saw that item, I would have picked it up," basically agreeing that O'Hara's crews should have spotted a 6-inch taillight shard if it was there. This implication hung heavy. Either the search team somehow missed giant pieces of evidence, which was unlikely given that they found 40 or more tiny bits of red plastic pieces, or those pieces were not there on January 29th and only appeared later, which veers into either someone planting evidence or extremely sloppy follow-up work by Proctor. Throughout all of this, Alan Jackson kept pressing Buchanick on the theme of integrity. He essentially asked in various ways, "Can you still say this investigation was done properly with integrity given all these issues?" And Buchanick, almost like a mantra, responded, "This investigation was conducted professionally with honor and integrity, and all the evidence pointed in one direction." He just kept repeating that same sentiment multiple times, even when Jackson directly challenged honor and integrity by Michael Proctor. But Buchanick didn't flinch, affirming that yes, even Proctor's work was done with integrity, a point that the defense clearly doesn't buy. And I don't either, because how could you? How could you stand by and say that, yeah, Michael Proctor handled this with honor and integrity while he's searching for nudes in the defendant's phone and calling her a retard? That's not honorable, and that's not showing integrity. During a brief redirect by the prosecutor, Buchanick was asked one more time about the investigation's integrity, giving him a chance to reaffirm his stance and maybe try to reclaim some credibility. And he delivered a line seemingly meant for the jury to carry into deliberation, saying, quote, "The investigation was done with honor, integrity, and all the evidence pointed in one direction and one direction only." By one direction, of course, he means towards Karen's guilt, and it was a confident soundbite, even if Jackson had worked hard to undercut it. As court adjourned on Thursday, tensions were running high, and in a rather unexpected move, Karen Reed herself addressed the media outside the courthouse after the jury left. And you don't typically see this, a defendant addressing the media while her court or her trial is ongoing, but while she was flanked by her attorneys, a defiant Karen Reed spoke to reporters about the case, and she doubled down on a key point of her defense, stating emphatically, "I saw John go in the house." And she's obviously referring to 34 Fairview. Now, this public assertion suggests that she's adamant that John made it into the house, implying that whatever happened to him happened after he was in the house. She said, quote, "You've seen this afternoon how much evidence has not been shown to this jury," hinting that there's a trove of information favorable to her that hasn't been presented in court yet. This could refer to things like certain phone records, data, or witness statements that the defense feels bolster their cover-up theory. The fact that she said this to the press was really bold, almost as if she were trying to sway public opinion or send a message to the judge, the prosecution, that the defense still has cards to play. And the prosecution can't respond because there is a gag order in place. But with that, I don't know how Karen Reed is actually allowed to like go out and talk about this case. But her impromptu press conference really caused a stir. Supporters of Karen, and there are many, they've been outside holding Justice for Karen and Free Karen Reed signs and even organized rallies during the week, cheered her on, treating her like a wrongfully accused heroine speaking truth to power. But more neutral observers were taken aback that she spoke at all. It's a risky move for a defendant to speak publicly during a trial because anything she says could theoretically be used against her or invite backlash. But Karen appeared resolute and even fired up. I mean, she's always fired up when she's doing these interviews for the media or in her documentaries. But the media, of course, jumped on her statements. Thursday evening's news featured clips of her declaring that John went inside, which is basically her accusing others at the party of not telling the whole truth. And that set the stage for an even more dramatic day on Friday, as everyone wondered, would the defense actually start naming alternative suspects or theories explicitly? Would we hear from Brian Albert or other people? And will the infamous Trooper Proctor himself end up called to testify, given how much he's been talked about? Karen told reporters that she didn't think Proctor would actually take the stand, but left open the possibility since he's on the defense witness list. So it was an exciting end to the day, almost like a mid-season finale in a TV show where the main character kind of breaks that fourth wall. And now with that, we're going to go into the last day of the week, Friday, May 10th. On Friday, Sergeant Yuri Bukinik was back on the stand in the morning to finish his cross-examination, and the defense continued to poke and prod at every loose thread in the investigation. One surprising avenue Alan Jackson pursued was the case of the Albert family's dog, a German Shepherd named Chloe. Now, why the dog? Well, there's been a fringe speculation that John's injuries, like all of the cuts and lacerations on his arm, could have come from a dog attack and not a car. Now, it might sound far-fetched, but the defense brought it up in a subtle way. Jackson asked Bukinik about Chloe. Specifically, he got Bukinik to admit that Chloe was given away after the incident and even had her name changed by new owners. Chloe is now called Cora. He also highlighted that Bukinik's report on the dog did not include who the new owners were or any of the rehoming details. I want to note that I believe Chloe was 6 years old at the time this all happened. So to just rehome a dog when she's been with you for 6 years after this incident definitely seems sus. So Alan Jackson highlighted that Bukinik's report on the dog did not include the new owners or any of the rehoming details. And Bukinik basically said, "I don't know," repeatedly when asked if he had any records of the dog's transfer. Now, the subtext the defense seemed to be suggesting was important things, even the dog, weren't fully investigated. And if you're a juror, you might be thinking, why are we even talking about the dog? But for those following outside theories, that was a nod to the idea that maybe the dog attacked John, because there were rumors that John was found near a dog run, or that the dog was present, or that the injuries on his arm looked like the result of a dog attack. And if you don't already know this, sometimes dogs can get very protective or aggressive, especially a German Shepherd, but that if they see somebody else fighting, they might jump in, kind of like a pack mentality response to assist in the fighting. And so a lot of people who have been watching this case believe that that's a very viable theory. But the prosecution didn't dwell on this. It's a bit of a red herring in their view, but it added yet another layer of reasonable doubt. And then Jackson also hammered on the timing of police reports. He asked Bukinik if he was aware that many official police reports in this case weren't written until hundreds of days after the events they describe. And that's pretty staggering if it's true. It would mean officers waited months or even a year to write up what happened, which opens the door to memory issues or story tweaking. Bukinik said he wasn't aware of that, and for jurors, that line probably reinforced the notion that the investigation might not have been as tight or prompt as it should have been. It dovetails with other testimony, like Levinson saying that she wasn't interviewed until 9 months later, and the defense was basically compiling a list of investigative delay and neglect. Again, each little point like this on its own isn't case-breaking, but together they're meant to seed doubt about whether Karen is truly guilty or whether this was a rush to judgment with a sloppy follow-up. But perhaps the biggest development Friday was the focus on Brian Higgins, the Boston ATF agent who was friends with Karen and was actually out with the group on the night in question. Now, to say that he is friends with Karen is really undermining their relationship, and we'll get into that. But the prosecution had avoided calling Higgins as a witness directly, and he hadn't testified thus far, but they used Bukinik to introduce some of Higgins' text messages with Karen. So through Bukinik, jurors heard that Brian Higgins exchanged a lot of friendly and flirtatious messages with Karen in the days and weeks before John's death. In one exchange, Karen vented to Higgins about how challenging it was to help raise John's niece and nephew. And she said that she felt like she was spread too thin and that it was sometimes a thankless task. So Brian Higgins responded with sympathy, saying, "You can vent, babe, and I get it." Even sharing that he understood because he had been married to someone in a similar situation. The messages had a certain emotional intimacy. Higgins calling Karen babe in text certainly suggests a closeness beyond just casual friends. And at one point, Jackson tried to bring up that the text thread referenced a kiss between Karen and Brian Higgins. Because yes, apparently at some point, Karen and Brian did exchange a kiss. I believe it was actually in John O'Keefe's garage after a little party that he had. But those messages were mentioned, or that kiss was mentioned in those messages. Now, the judge sustained an objection on that, meaning the jury didn't hear details about a kiss, just that it was referenced, but the implication wasn't lost. And the prosecution's goal with these texts might be to hint at a possible motive. Perhaps John and Karen's relationship was strained or Karen had affections elsewhere. However, it's a double-edged sword because those same texts show that Karen confiding personal stresses to a friend doesn't directly prove anything about a murder, but also gives Brian Higgins motive to do away with John as well. So naturally, the defense seized on the Higgins topic to further their cover-up angle. Jackson asked Buchanek whether Higgins had ever handed over his phone for full forensic analysis, and Buchanek admitted that Higgins never gave them his actual phone, only a printout of the text messages. Essentially, Higgins self-reported the texts he thought were relevant. Now, of course, the subtext here is that if police were so rigorous, why didn't they forensically dump Higgins' phone data? Was it because he's law enforcement and they gave him a pass? Could Higgins have deleted anything else? It's a subtle insinuation, but the defense is painting an image of a preferential or incomplete investigation when it came to people other than Karen. Buchanek also confirmed that he learned Higgins was actually present with the group at the Waterfall Bar that night. So Higgins was part of the evening's events, yet he has not been called to testify yet and wasn't treated with the same scrutiny as Karen. This feeds the defense narrative that investigators zeroed in on Karen and did not fully investigate others, possibly because those others are in law enforcement circles. By midday Friday, the prosecution signaled that they were nearly done with their case or their portion of the trial, and one significant piece remained, which was the testimony from two minor witnesses, specifically John O'Keefe's young niece and nephew. These are the children that Karen and John were looking after the night of the party, and the judge and lawyers arranged for the minors to testify privately in a closed courtroom with no cameras allowed to protect their privacy. So we don't have a public account of what the kids said, and we likely won't unless it comes out in summary. However, their expected testimony might involve the moment that Karen left John's house with them that night or any interactions that they observed. Perhaps the niece, who was a teenager, I believe, could testify if John ever made it inside or not, or what time Karen returned in the morning. It's speculative, but the fact that the prosecution wanted them heard implies that they have something useful to add. And with that, court wrapped up for the week. And if you've made it this far, kudos to you, man. This has been so exhausting to cover. I can only imagine how kind of tiring or exhausting it is to try and listen to it all, or at least catch bits and pieces of it. So I really appreciate you sticking with me through this. I'm really trying hard to diligently follow this trial to give you guys as much as I can of an unbiased approach, like, you know, detailing both sides and what they're putting on the table. But you all know kind of where I stand and where I think the majority stands. I guess we will see, though, when the jury gets to decide what their verdict is, where we all really stand. So I will catch you guys up on Monday with the trial recaps day by day of next week. And we're going to see this all the way through, all the way to verdict. So thank you so much for sticking with me. I'll catch you on the next episode. Stay vigilant. Stay curious. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.